Good evening. It's a blessing to be here together tonight. I hope you had a good afternoon. Hope you got some much needed rest. Just real quick, a show of hands. How many of you ate out today for lunch? Wow. Fewer than I thought. Well, maybe you normally do and you just didn't today. Whatever the case may be, even if you thought about eating out today, there's one thing I'm pretty certain of. There's one place you didn't eat today. And I'm pretty sure that I can guess that. That's one thing we all have in common is nobody here ate at Chick-fil-A today. Why? Because they're closed on Sundays, right? God's chicken. They rest on Sundays so that that chicken can live another day. There's something about Chick-fil-A that fascinates me is when we were going to Destin for vacation, we stopped on our way down at a Chick-fil-A for lunch. And it's no different than the Chick-fil-A here in Cookeville. The line was wrapped completely around the building multiple times. The inside was barren, but the line around was pretty long. And we stopped there, and I could tell my mom looked at me, and she goes, "Are we really going to try to eat here?" "Yes, Mom, we're going to try to eat here. That's normal, but they're pretty fast about getting us." And we go inside, and there's no one there. And she looks at me, and she goes, "I cannot believe this place is that busy, that drive-thru." I'm like, that's always the case at Chick-fil-A. It's always like that. And I've always wondered, why is it always like that? Because let's just be honest, the food's good, but there's nothing like spectacular about their chicken. I can fry chicken. Look, I'm just saying, I've been frying chicken for a long time. I worked at the Sitgo in Jackson County. I smelt like fried chicken every day. I can fry some good chicken. There's a lot of things I may not be good at cooking, but I'd put my chicken, fried chicken, up with the best of them. Promise you. There's nothing special about their fried chicken. Some people don't like it because it's not crispy enough. It's not that extra crispy type of chicken breading. If you want that, you go somewhere like Popeye's chicken or KFC. It's just not as crispy, but it's got a good flavor and everything. But I've always wondered what's so great about Chick-fil-A that it just attracts everyone to it. And I think it comes down to their business model. See, one of my best friends for many years, right out of college, couldn't find a job, so he moved to Arkansas to live with his sister, and he just, to make some extra money, he started working in the kitchen at Chick-fil-A. Long story short, he works himself up to being one of the head honchos at the store there. He ran the ship. He was the one that, you know, told everyone what to do. Had a good little time there before switching careers. But one of the things I learned about Chick-fil-A is when they bring in new hires, there's this concept that they teach every new hire. And they call it second mile service. Second mile service. They want their employees to go above and beyond. Not just provide good customer service, but they want you to meet and exceed expectations in customer service. And I don't know what it is about this phrase, "my pleasure," but I started using that at work. If you say "my pleasure" to someone more so than "you're welcome," it just hits different for some reason. My pleasure, I've had some of the rudest people that I've had to deal with, and the moment they say thanks, and I say, "my pleasure," you just hear it in their voice. Their tone changes immediately. There's something about that phrase. But Chick-fil-A prides itself on second mile service. But the thing about it is this idea of second mile service, it should not be a new concept to us. It should be something that we're very familiar with. Not only familiar with reading and hearing about, but also familiar with practicing in our lives. It's something that most of us have heard, but it's something that Jesus values a lot. In fact, in his first sermon that we have recorded of Jesus, Jesus deals with this idea of second mile service or second mile Christianity. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in its context here. And then we're going to go to this concept of what drives second mile service. What motivates us towards second mile service? Is second mile service something that can be faked? Or is it something that has to be authentic in order to truly take place? In Matthew chapter 5, beginning with verse 38 through the end of the chapter, Jesus ultimately is dealing with how we should treat others. And more specifically in context, he's dealing a lot with retaliation here. But I think there's a lot of truth and a lot applicable to what we're going to talk about in our everyday lives here. Jesus begins here in verse 38 with this phrase that he uses five different times in Matthew chapter 5 when he says, "You've heard that it was said," or "it is written," some translations say. See, ultimately, what Jesus is doing here, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, most of my Christian life, and especially early on into preaching, I believe Jesus was teaching new concepts here. I believe that Jesus was taking the old law and taking it a step further. And I still hear preachers say that today. I disagree with that, and here's why. Everything that Jesus taught here can be found in the old law. Every single thing. What Jesus is ultimately doing here is saying, these religious teachers, these people that you've been looking to for the answers of your spirituality and how to live your faithful life, they have taken this law and they've corrupted it, is what he's saying. They've taught this, and then Jesus comes and speaks with authority and says, "But I say this." He's not adding to anything of the law there. He's actually teaching the law in its purest form to them. Teaching it the way that it was written, the way, and we'll look at some of that here in context as well. Jesus ultimately here is coming on the scene to do some damage control. He's doing some damage control. He's having to unravel some false teaching that has occurred in that time. Jesus says here, "You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." If you go back to Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18, the text says, "You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Deuteronomy 19, 18 and verse 2, "The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." Now here's the thing. This had been really manipulated and corrupted to say, if someone does this to you, then do the equal back to them. And that's not how the law was intended. That person was to stand trial, as we would see it today. That person was to stand trial. There were to be witnesses there. And if it be deemed acceptable by those that were they were standing trial in front of, then yeah, there may be a hand for a hand, an eye for an eye situation. But the law wasn't saying if someone does something to you, you turn right around and do the same thing to them. That's never what the law said. The whole premise of the law when dealing, even going back to the Ten Commandments, the first four dealing with loving God, the last six dealing with loving our neighbor, when Jesus said the greatest command is this, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself, on these two laws hang what? All the law and the prophets. It's the summation of what God intended from the beginning. Love Him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. So the law had become corrupted by many of these teachers. And Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile with him, you go with him too. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you." Jesus ultimately trying to get a point across here says, don't give people what you think they deserve, give them more. Do not give people what you think they deserve, give them more. Don't repay them with what the world says to repay them with. Give them something more, give them something different. He says, someone slaps you on one cheek, you turn and you give them the other cheek. These are some things that are really unnatural. You know, I made this statement one time. I said, sometimes Jesus asks us to do some things that go against our natural instincts, that just don't make sense, that are kind of unnatural to us. And someone said, Jesus would never ask that of me. And I said, let me hit you in the face and see if your first instinct is to turn and let me do it again. Because quite frankly, there's two types of people that I've come in contact with. There's people that fight and there's people that flight, okay? You hit them and they run, or you hit them and they come back swinging. Sadly, I'm the one that you hit them and I come back swinging, okay? I just don't think about it. I have that gut instinct sometimes to do that. I think about one time, I think I was in like 7th or 8th grade, and I was at a church camp. We were doing a retreat at Camp Discovery. Camp Discovery gave me nightmares as a kid, staying there. I'm sorry, but that gave me nightmares. I'm talking the old rusted out hospital beds. Dude, it's the perfect setup for a horror movie. You're right on the lake, you know, the river there. I was expecting like Jason to come out or something. It was perfect. I didn't sleep that weekend. But I'll never forget, you know, you put a bunch of teenage boys in a room. We're going to flex on each other and see who's the toughest. Boys are going to wrestle. That's our way of, you know, who's the top dog. Now, I'll never forget, a kid was trying to get me to fight, and I have been one of those that I don't fight because I don't want to get in trouble. I was always afraid of getting in trouble. So I never did. I always, you know, would try to keep that in check. And a kid was trying to get me to fight, and he, you know, there is nothing worse. I would rather someone punch me in the nose than slap me in the face. There's just something about being slapped open-handed that I just can't stand. And that kid hauled off, and he slapped me, and I took off after him. And the counselors come in, and they break it up, and they say, "Eric, what would Jesus say about this? He would say, turn the other cheek." And I said, "I did, and he hit that one too." Okay? I'm running out of cheeks here for him to hit. Jesus says, look, someone gives someone hits you on one cheek, you turn and you give them the other. Someone insults you. Someone shows contempt for you. Someone is deeply offensive towards you. He says, you don't give in to that. You turn and you give them the other. Jesus said, if someone would sue you and take your tunic, let them have your cloak as well. He says, be willing to give what is owed and be willing to give them even more. Be willing to give what is owed and be willing to give them even more. I think of a text that comes to mind that shows this an example. And it's a story we're all familiar with in Luke 19 of Zacchaeus, the wee little man, the tax collector who climbed up in that sycamore tree to see and to hear Jesus. And as Jesus tells him to come down, you know, I'm going to your house this day. Many people find frustration with that and they come to Jesus. And Zacchaeus says, wait a minute, and there's a little bit of confusion as to what Zacchaeus is trying to say in the text, because it can be interpreted one or two ways. And the Greek really kind of points more towards the one that I didn't hear a lot of growing up. But Zacchaeus says, you know, if I've stolen from them, I give back to them. If I've taken from them, I did this. You know, a lot of people put that if there and say, oh, well, Zacchaeus was saying he's going to go right his wrongs. But in the Greek, it actually looks like Zacchaeus may be saying, I was an honest tax collector. I never did these things. If I did something, I made it right. I already took care of that. But the principle is this. Zacchaeus shows us that principle of, you know, I'm willing to give back tenfold, twofold, however much more to make amends, to make things right in these situations. And it just doesn't come natural to us. Jesus says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile with them, you go with them 2 miles. Go with them 2 miles. In that day, Israel, the Jews, they were not a free people. They were under Roman government. The Roman officials had every bit of rule over them. They did give them certain freedoms when it came to their religion. They didn't care about Judaism at that time. If you wanted to practice Judaism, practice it. But there were certain things that the Jews didn't have full rights over, one being capital punishment. That's why Jesus had to stand for trial before the Romans. He'd already stood trial before the Jews, and the Jews said, you're guilty. So under the Jewish law, they should have been able to kill him right there. But sad thing, truth is for them, they weren't under Jewish law. They were under Roman law. So they had to stand before the Romans and get Roman approval in order to crucify Christ. But in that day, if a soldier came up to you and you're on the street and they compelled you and said, hey, you're going to carry my sack, you're going to carry my stuff, you had to do it. And you had to go with them at least 1 mile. 1 mile. And then your service was over. It wasn't something, though, you know, you got to think. This is a foreign group of people that have invaded you, that have taken you ultimately hostage, giving you some liberty, some freedom. This isn't something that you're just excited to do. Okay, I'm the type of person, especially in today's climate, I try to go above and beyond on doing this. When I see an individual that it's very clear they were a veteran, I go out of my way to thank them. To thank them for their service. I go out of my way with police officers to thank them for their service. Why? These people are protecting me. These people are protecting my freedoms. That wasn't the case here, though. That would be like another country comes over and invades America and takes America hostage, and their soldiers come up to you and say, hey, you're going to carry my stuff. It wasn't an honorable thing to do. wasn't something that you found joy in doing. So you did the bare minimum so that you could just get out of it alive. Get out of it without going to prison or being beaten to death. No one would have thought, well, hey, while we're here, let's go another mile together. Let's get to know each other. That wasn't how people thought. Then Jesus goes on to say, give to one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Be willing to give to those who genuinely have a need. I believe the heart of all of this is found in the attitude that it has to take to go the second mile. Jesus is telling us, yep, do what is required of you, but then do more. In Romans chapter 12, Paul kind of gets to the spirit or the heart of this as well. When he says, beginning in verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, you feed him. If he's thirsty, you give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. This is the attitude that should separate us from the world. The attitude to where people see there's something different about us. That attitude not only reflects true godly kindness, but it ultimately reflects true godly love. True godly love. I think about what Jesus teaches about forgiveness, and I think it's a perfect example of what we're dealing with here in Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. Peter says in verse 21, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, I did not say to you seven times, but 70 times seven. Some translations say 77 times, some say 70 times seven. The point that Jesus is trying to get across here, though, is not keeping some tally mark list of, hey, I've reached my, 400 and something times, so we're good. I don't got to forgive you again. The point that Jesus is teaching here is you think that seven is this perfect, this complete, this holy number of I've done it seven times, so I've hit my limit, my spiritual limit on forgiveness. And his point is saying, go the extra mile with that. Go the second mile with that thought on forgiveness. That as often as it is asked of you forgive. That you put it behind you, that you treat that person with forgiveness. But the thing of it is, it's not easy. It's often difficult, and oftentimes we quit way too quick on these things. We want to get by with the absolute minimum. We bail out after our obligation is completed. We oftentimes look for the easiest path. You know, the thing about going easy, the easiest path is if we continue to take the easy path in life, we are not going to develop the muscle and the endurance to get through it. You know, I used to have a workout partner, and then work schedules changed, and so we get together once a week. But we do the same workout regimen. Sometimes we change certain things due to our physical limitations or needs, but we change certain things. But the main thing that we do, though, is we keep each other accountable. Why? So I like heavy things. I like picking up something heavy and putting it down. You know what I don't like? Getting my heart rate up really, really fast. Okay, I don't like that. And then I went to the doctor, and he's like, hey, you're 32 now. It's time to get some extensive blood work done. And then my level, I was like, I'm healthy as a horse. Then my blood work came back, and I was like, whew, there's some improvement here. My doctor looked at me, and he said, hey, I just want to know, have you heard of this thing called a treadmill? I was like, that's what you hang your jackets on, right? He's like, do you do any kind of cardio? And I said, well, I move weight faster. And he said, that doesn't count. So for about 4 months now, I've been changing some things up. And the first time I did that, my heart rate got up. My body went into panic mode and was like, you're dying, it's over. I'm writing my last will and testament there. But we hold each other accountable because the honest truth is sometimes I'll be in there the one day we lift together and I'll be in the cardio and we'll be doing some things and I'll be like, okay, we're supposed to do 52 laps of this, okay? And here's how I count to 52, 1, 2, skip a few, 49, 50, 51, 52. And it'll be like, hey, by the way, you skipped two, go. But I want to stop there. No, you can't stop there because it's going to make it that much harder on you in the long run. You're not going to get to where you want to go. You're not going to get to the level that you want to be. I think when it comes to our spirituality, it's the same thing. If we continue to just do the bare minimum, if we continue to just seek the easy way out in our faith, we're not going to develop the muscle and the endurance for the second mile. And also what we do is we miss the opportunity that most often lies in doing the difficult and in denying our rights, our rest, and our relaxation. See, when you get down to the motivation of these miles, motivation for mile number one is this: law and obligation. That's it. Why do I go the first mile? Because I'm obligated to go the first mile. That's it. Law and obligation. Checklist. You've heard of checklist for religion? That's checklist spirituality right there, 101. I go 1 mile. Do the bare minimum that's expected of me. Law and obligation. What's the motivation, though, for going mile number two? It's ultimately motivated by love. It cannot be faked. It's authentic. It's different. The second mile is motivated by something other than law or just what is expected. Romans chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, Paul says, "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor or kindness." First thing, let love be genuine. Let it be real. Let it be authentic. I think sometimes we, in religion, we try to trick people into thinking our love is genuine. What I mean by that is oftentimes when if we treat the church like a business to where like this almost like a marketing scheme to where it's like, okay, we're going to place people here and here and you're going to be overly friendly to them when they come in. That's your assignment for this Sunday. And then you're going to be over here and you're going to do this and you're going to do that. It's fake. I mean, it's fake. And I think most of us are wise enough to know when someone is being genuinely kind to us and someone is being fake. And fake religion, that turns people off left and right. So I don't care, you know, how you got people strategically planned. If it's not genuine, it's not going to fulfill its purpose. It's not. Paul says, start with letting your love be genuine. Let it be real. Let it be authentic. But then he gets into this competitive attitude as he ends, and he says, look, if you're going to try to one-up one another, if you're going to try to outdo each other in something, try to outdo one another in showing honor or kindness. Make it your goal to, you know, I'm going to be kind to them. I'm going to be kind to them. And I'm going to go out of my way. I'm going to go the second mile. Because ultimately, the second mile, what it's going to do is it's going to get us out of the comfort seat of our pews. And it's going to get us invested in the lives of others, is what it's going to achieve. Second mile Christianity is driven by love. But not just any kind of love. It can't be faked. It has to be genuine. It has to be real. It has to be authentic. Love that comes from somewhere different. Mile number two is motivated by the love for Christ. Think about in Matthew, the 25th chapter. Matthew 25. And we're very familiar with this. When Jesus, the text says, separates those on his right and his left as a shepherd with the sheep from the goat. And those on the left, they're kind of shocked by Jesus' response to them of, you know, depart from me. I never knew you. Lord, we cast out devils in your name. We did mighty works in your name. Ultimately, if I can paraphrase that with this lesson, we went the first mile for you, Lord. We did the checklist stuff. Jesus says, but here's the problem. I was naked and you didn't clothe me. I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was in prison, you didn't visit me. I was thirsty, you didn't give me drink. I was in need and you overlooked me. And that's when he looks to the others and he says, look, I was hungry and you fed me. You know what I find interesting there? I'm not saying that the first mile isn't important. I'm not saying that at all. He makes no mention of the other group doing anything with the other stuff. He makes no mention of their mighty works. He makes no mention of them prophesying, of them casting out devils. None of that. He just says, I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. You went the second mile for me. You got out of your comfort zone. You got out of your state of relaxation. And you did something. You helped me. Lord, when do we see you in these situations and help you? We never saw you in these situations. He says, every time you did it to one of them, you did it to me. You know, it's amazing when you start seeing Jesus in people, how that changes how you see people. I think about the story of Jonah. We've been talking about Jonah in our college class. We just finished that up this morning. And one of the things that always fascinated me in the past few years about Jonah was how it ends. Because growing up, I couldn't tell you how Jonah ended. I could tell you that Jonah ran from God. Jonah was swallowed by a big fish. Jonah was then spit up by the big fish, went to Nineveh, preached to Nineveh. Nineveh repents. The end. That's not the end of the story. Jonah goes out from Nineveh, sits down, and stares at Nineveh, just praying that God will destroy them. Just hoping for that slightest chance that they'll be destroyed. God then causes a nice shade tree to come up over Jonah. Jonah finds great comfort and relaxation in that shade. The text says God allows a worm then to come in and destroy that tree. Then a great wind blows through. It gets really hot. Jonah becomes faint, which means he probably becomes severely dehydrated. Jonah is begging to God to kill him, and God says, wait a minute. Do you do right by complaining over the death of this tree? Jonah says, yeah, I do. I have every right to be mad right now, every right to be frustrated, and every right to be frustrated to the point of death. And God's like, you don't get it. What about that city of 120,000 people and their cattle? And it ends with that question. And I believe it ends with that question. I believe the Spirit allowed for it to end that way, for us to not know how Jonah responds, to know nothing else at that point, to cause us to then look at people and say, how do you feel about them? How do you feel about those people that you come in contact with every day? How do you view those people that you look at and that you may look at as a little lesser than you? Or not worth the grace and forgiveness and mercy of God? In fact, of all things to complain about, Jonah's biggest complaint towards God was, I knew this would happen. That's why I ran away from you, he says. Because if I go there and they repent, I know that you're a God full of mercy, compassion, and grace. Of all things to complain about when it comes to God. God, how dare you be merciful and gracious and compassionate? I'm convinced the reason why grace makes so many Christians uncomfortable is because they're first-mile Christians. Because I believe second-miler Christians understand their need for grace, their need for mercy, their need for compassion. First-mile Christians look at it as merely obligation. I'm fulfilling the law. I've done my checklist. Look at how good I am. In fact, I remember asking a question one time growing up. I asked the question as a young boy. I said, you know, if I were to die tonight, I'd become a Christian at that time, and I said, if I were to die tonight, how would I know whether or not I'm going to heaven? The answer I was given and the answer that I used to explain to people and the answer that I used to live by, past tense, was this answer. Well, if you've done more good in your life than you have bad. That is 100% works-based salvation, merit-based salvation. And that is what Jesus is trying to get us out of the mindset of thinking like here. You want to love your neighbor? Be willing to go the second mile for your neighbor. Be willing to go the second mile for your neighbor. See, it's when we outdo others in showing honor, love, and kindness. People are pointed to Jesus that way. Jesus says in John 13, beginning with verse 34, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this, Man, I wish if there was one thing that the church today would grab a hold of and read over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, it'd be this verse. By this, people will know you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Kind of chokes me up thinking about it. People say, oh, we need to go back to some of the old school style of preaching. We need to go back to the basics. I got lectured one time how I needed to go back and do a sermon series on premillennialism. How many of y'all know what that word premillennialism is? You know what's funny? A lot of people think they know. I heard premillennialism one time was having donuts in Bible class. That ain't premillennialism. I was like, you obviously don't know what you're talking about, but we do need more education on it because you don't know what the definition of it is. But hey, whatever. Church, I think we do need to get back to the basics. The very foundation of how Jesus said people would know that we are disciples of His by our love for one another. You can label that whatever you want to label it, but the honest truth is there's nothing other to label that other than biblical. It came from His very mouth. When we go the second mile, we begin pointing others to Jesus. But you also need to know this. It is impossible to go the second mile with others without influencing others. It's impossible to go that second mile without influencing people. It only takes one second miler to cause change. Think back to Matthew 5, what we just talked about with the Roman soldier. Imagine the surprise of the Roman soldier when he gets to that first mile with you and he's expecting you to set that bag down and make him carry it. And you look at that soldier and you say, hey, how about we go another one together? How about we go another mile? He's not expecting that. He's expecting 1 mile out of you. You've done your obligation. You've done your duty. You've met your commitment. And you look at him and you say, hey, let's go another one. I'll carry your bags another mile. You're huffing, you're puffing, you're tired, and yet you don't put his bag down. You continue to walk with him. It would have been shocking, but I have a hard time believing that it wouldn't have made at least some sort of an impact on that soldier. Imagine the influence we could have if we decided to show second mile kindness to all of those around us. Second mile love to all of those around us. You know, I got corrected on this by a firefighter. I haven't researched it. I guess there's truth to it. But and he was talking about it rare occasions and with forest fires. But my statement is anytime I use an earthly illustration, there's always going to be flaws with it because it's an earthly illustration. But generally speaking, we oftentimes say, sometimes you got to fight fire with fire. And there is some truth to that. With forest fires, you might start a controlled fire outside of it so that when it burns up, it burns up. It doesn't just keep spreading. There's some truth to that. But for the most part, let's think about this when you're dealing with people. For the most part, when we try to fight fire with fire, all it does is start a bigger fire. I don't know about you, but in most, more times than not, the solution to fighting fire is water. Why? It puts the fire out. It doesn't make the fire bigger. Oftentimes we fight fire with fire, and all we're doing is making the fire bigger. And it turns into a who can yell the loudest match. And you get nowhere. You get nowhere with people. The only way for good to win over evil is for good to go beyond the expectations of those in this world. We must be willing to go beyond their expectations. The second mile in our lives makes the Roman world ask, why in the world would these people go the extra distance under such a heavy burden? Why in the world would people do this? You know what the second mile also does? It opens up conversation. It opens up conversation. It builds relationships, and relationships lead to conversations that would never have happened in the first mile. The second mile makes us better humans. Most importantly, it makes us better Christians. It builds the muscle and the endurance that we need to carry the gospel. It builds the endurance for us to remain faithful through the seasons of life, not just for a season of life. Jesus teaches us here a valuable lesson as we close tonight. A valuable lesson about going beyond obligation, that's truly what love your neighbor as yourself means. To go beyond obligation. You will only find opportunity when you are willing to walk the second mile. Here's the thing. Sometimes I think we get distracted by things. We have worries about things. I don't want you to worry about the burden of it wearing you out. Mark talked this morning about our priorities, about seeking first the kingdom of God. I don't want you to worry about the burden of going the second mile wearing you out, because here's the thing. If your priorities are where they should be, if your focus is where it should be, you'll find rest when you reach your destination. Jesus says, and I believe that applies in this life as well as the next, "Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest." The source of good, solid rest is Jesus. That's the source, that's the comfort, and knowing that I can lay my head on my pillow at night, and when I go to sleep, I'm really trying to focus on this, because one of the things I'm learning is this. There's always an excuse to worry. Always. There's always a reason to worry. Always. You got kids, there's a reason to worry every single night. With all of that distraction, I found that there's two really good things to cure anxiety. Not to cure, but I guess to suppress. I may be talking out. This is not from a medical. This is from experience. I'm going to put this there. If it's bad advice, just ignore it, okay? I'm sure I'll hear about it, Dr. Loftus. But with anxiety, at least for me, the best thing I can do to get rid of anxiety is to keep my mind busy. And the best way to keep my mind busy is to be active doing something. So if you take all these worries, all the anxieties, and you say, okay, I'm going to put that energy that I am on worrying and being anxious into serving someone else, guess what? You won't notice that anxiety. You won't notice that worry. And when you go home at night, guess what? You'll be tired. And you can find rest, because you can find rest knowing that you spent your day showing other people Jesus in your life. You can find some of the best rest knowing that. It helps. It may not completely get rid of it. It may not cure it. It's a good start, though. It's a good starting point. Tonight, I want you to think about if you really understand the concept of loving your neighbor as yourself. I'll go the second mile for myself if I love you as I love myself. I've got to be willing to go the second mile for you. One short story that I tell, and then we'll close. I always thought I loved others like I loved myself. And I'd pat myself on the back and I'd be like, well, I bought them a cheeseburger when they were hungry. I went over to the McDonald's and bought them something off a dollar menu. And then someone asked me a question one day. They said, how often are you willing to go eat off that dollar menu? I don't think McDonald's has very good hamburgers. I'm not a fan. Okay, my mama makes, hand-patted burgers. They're thick, they're big, it's a burger, okay? What they make, that ain't a burger. I don't know what it is, but it ain't a burger. I won't eat it. I don't know if I necessarily really love them as I love myself, because I'm putting something in their mouth that I would never put in mine. I'll buy you a burger off the dollar menu. Hey, what about a steak? Nuh-uh. Too expensive. I'm buying you no steak. But I thought you loved me as you loved yourself. Think about it. It's something to wrestle with. Do we really understand loving our neighbor as we love ourselves? If we do, it means we're willing to go the second mile for our neighbor. we're willing to go the second mile for them. If you're not a Christian tonight, we want to take time to meet that need. We would love nothing more. I like to put this in invitations just because I don't want to single one group out and say, you know, because there may be people here that have questions about it. And not necessarily at this moment say, hey, I want to become a Christian, but I sure do have some questions about it. This is open for you as well. If you want to study more about it, talk more about it, if you got some things that are hanging you up on that, look, let's study about it, let's pray about it. If you need to make that commitment tonight, we want to meet that need. If you're a Christian and you're struggling, we want to go the second mile for you. Not just start, you know, the second mile doesn't begin and end with prayer. It doesn't end with praying for them. The second mile goes from us saying, okay, we're going to help take your burden, whether spiritual or physical, and we're going to help you carry that burden. As long as it takes. As long as it takes. So if you have a spiritual need and you feel comfortable with coming forward tonight, we've set this time aside for you. So if you have a need tonight, please come while we stand and while we sing.